Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
It belongs to me. Get off my world. It's pain.
Get off my world.
Get off my world. If you don't, you're gonna get it.
Get off my world.
Get off my world. Or I'm gonna bury you.
I'm Kelvin.
I'm Pat.
And I'm Joshua.
And this is Get Off My World. We're three guys who love the classic Doctor Who series and try our best to love the new series too. We'll take you through five rounds rapid and get to the bottom of what's great and not so great about our favorite show. Round one, Temporal Grace. As fans, we sometimes get a little curmudgeonly even about the show we love. That's why we open each podcast with something that makes our crusty old hearts flutter with unconditional squee. And I guess I'll start off with something I saw on Twitter today. Someone tweeted the cover of a comedy album that John Pertwee apparently recorded sometime before being cast as the Doctor. I'm making that assumption because his hair was not completely gray on the cover of the album. And it had, I wish I could remember the exact title of it, but it was something like John Pertwee Sings Songs of the Vulgar Boatman. And the cover is John Pertwee in some sort of, like, Venetian gondolier outfit with a concertina. Like, sort of, like, leering at this barmaid woman. And the barmaid woman has that, like, sort of 1940s pin-up shocked expression. You know, where her mouth is really round and she's got, like, her hand to the side of her face, you know. And so I'm guessing it's an album of John Pertwee singing dirty sea shanties.
So this must have been mid-60s, late 60s.
I'm guessing, yeah. I mean, he did get a start in, like, musical comedies.
Yeah.
So it must have been came out of that somehow.
Well, if anyone can link us to some MP3s,
I saw this and, like, okay, here's another thing I got to look for somewhere. Somewhere someone's ripped this album and has it posted somewhere.
I do have a CD of novelty Doctor Who songs that has John Pertwee doing something called I Am the Doctor.
Oh, yeah, where he goes, like, I will destroy the universe.
Yeah, it's very...
And all these undoctorly things.
Portentous. And,
yeah.
Yeah, and quite bad, but it's a fun album.
Yeah, he should have done some dirty shanty songs.
I want to spend my Christmas with the Dalek. That is the worst song in the world, man. I play it every holiday season.
Well, here's what I'm excited about,
okay,
boys. We're going to be talking about the Gunfighters later in this episode, which drew me to my bookshelf where I picked up my old Target novelization of The Gunfighters by Donald Cotton. And I started reading it and I couldn't put it down. I don't know if you've read this, but this is an amazing book. It's written in the first person from the point of view of a journalist from the late 1880s named Ned Buntline.
And he's, oh, God!
Yes. He's essentially interviewing a terminally ill Doc Holliday about what really happened at the OK Corral.
Oh, God.
And so most of it's in first person from Ned's point of view recounting Doc Holliday's exploits with the Doctor. And it is only very loosely based on the TV script. But it uses all the really over-the-top Wild West diction that is sprinkled throughout the TV show, but it's really embraced in this book. And I'm going to read you just a, like, two-sentence excerpt here.
Okay.
Because it may be one of the best descriptions of the Doctor operating the TARDIS console that I've ever read. The Doctor was clutching at an apparently haphazard selection of levers with the air of a demented xylophonist who finds he's brought along the wine list instead of the score. So really, essentially,
that's pretty good.
This is basically if they made Tom Waits watch The Gunfighters once and then write the novel. Only he was really smashed and doesn't remember much of it.
That's fascinating.
Track this down and read it. It is
that's remarkable.
Awesome.
Well, I mean, you know, Ned Buntline was the king of the dime novels.
That character in Unforgiven was probably based on him.
Yeah.
So Donald Cotton, was he the one who wrote The Gunfighters for?
Yes.
Television as well,
yep.
And did he also write The Mythmakers? Because that's
I believe so,
yeah.
Or the Romans.
The
too.
Novelization of The Mythmakers is told from the point of view of Homer, as I remember. So that seems like the kind of shtick that he likes to do.
Homer and Ned Buntline. Wow, that's
ventriloquism for you.
Yeah.
Well, so I've got kind of a thing here. It's pertinent to our discussion of Vengeance on Varos that we talked about last episode. So here in the Twin Cities at the Walker Art Center, they, for the last month, have been running a retrospective of the films of the director Derek Jarman. So my wife and I have gone to see them. And Derek Jarman made a wide range of films. The first one, his first feature-length film, was from 1979, a movie called Jubilee, which I encourage all of our listeners to track down and watch because it's totally crazy. It's really interesting. It's a kind of time capsule of early punk, post-punk, new wave Britain of the time. There's various figures from that period there. The woman who played Magenta on Rocky Horror Picture Show. Susie Sue is in there somewhere. It's Adam Ant's first role.
Nice.
He's one of the leads. He's got to be like 17 years old. He looks like a baby. So, but pertinent for Doctor Who is that there's a character in there, kind of a Rupert Murdoch-esque character. He's a record producer named Borja Ginz. He's played by a guy, I had to look this up, but his name is Jack Burkett, but he's usually known by his stage name, The Incredible Orlando. It's apparently a well-known figure at the time. He was totally blind. You can see that in the movie, whatever. And his performance is this kind of hysterical and creepy, over-enunciated diction, which is so campy, and it is absolutely 100% what Nabil Shaban based his performance as Syl on. I am 100% convinced of it. The only thing that's missing is that creepy little the tongue
the slurping.
Thing, yeah. The slurping thing that he does. And now I've never...
Did he eat marshmallow?
He did. No, it's purely in the diction. It's just possible that they're both basing their performance on some third person that I'm not aware of, but I'm pretty sure that he must have based it on this. And as further supporting evidence to that, the movie we saw a few weeks ago, Derek Jarman's Wittgenstein, that they were playing at the Walker, has Nabil Shaban in it. This is a few years after Vengeance on Varos. He plays a Martian dressed in a green costume with green face paint and those ridiculous little antennae that you might wear on, like, St. Patrick's Day or something.
So at least he wasn't typecast.
It was, right.
After Doctor Who, that's good.
And he's talking to the young Ludwig Wittgenstein about weird philosophical questions. So both of these performers were part of Derek Jarman's stable of performers. They could well have known each other, and he certainly had seen the performance in Jubilee when
that's
he based it on Vengeance on Varos. It was astonishing. And I love this about Doctor Who, is that it puts a kind of lens in front of you where you run into crazy things in the world. You're like, Doctor Who got this from that.
Yeah, so Shaban apparently had a heck of a career playing repulsive little aliens.
Little alien things, yeah.
It's like, well, you know, you keep playing the same character. No, that one time I was playing a blue repulsive alien, and Doctor Who, I was clearly a green repulsive alien.
And now it's time for round two, Special Topics Dalek. Today, Kelvin will surprise us with an unexpected discussion topic. Kelvin, go!
My topic of discussion is, what is your favorite two-part Doctor Who story? There was that season of the Sixth Doctor where every episode was technically a two-parter.
Yep.
True.
Like Vengeance on Varos.
Like Vengeance on Varos. And I kind of don't want... I want those to kind of be excluded because that was like the format of that time.
Okay.
Fair enough. And that was only done that one year, with the exception of The Ultimate Foe.
Oh, so you're putting that back on the table.
That the ultimate foe will be on the table because right. That was the still the okay. The half hour.
It's not segments. Episode 13 and 14 of Trial of a Time Lord.
This well, ugly, yeah, really we could. That's a whole other discussion. But yeah, yeah. I didn't, you know, because there was that one oddball season where they did something different.
I get your parameters. I understand what you're coming from. So we could list them first. I mean, there's Edge of Destruction, yep. Black Orchid, The Awakening. The Suntaran experiment.
The King's Demons.
King's Demons. And
some geek out there is screaming some episode.
Yeah, and Ghostlight was three episodes.
Yep.
Yeah. Survival was three episodes.
Yep. Yeah. No two and episodes with Sylvester.
Planet McCoy. Of the Giants was three episodes.
Yep.
So and we're discarding those for purposes of this discussion. It's two-parters only that you want.
Yeah, I was specifically thinking two-parters.
Okay,
so that also doesn't include Mission to the Unknown.
Yeah, right.
Which
right.
was one episode.
That's not episode one of Dalek's Master Plan.
I like that this discussion is more parameters than discussion.
Well, okay, if it's only two-part classic shows, then we've only got, what, four or five to work from?
Yeah, yes. Something like that.
All right. I'm going to go with Black Orchid then.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's probably not a controversial choice. It's not really all that great by Doctor Who standards, and it's certainly not great by Agatha Christie country house murder standards either, but it's...
By two-part Doctor Who standards.
That's right. It's top gold. Tier. It's in the top five at least.
It is kind of an odd story to just show up, like... Mm-hmm. Purely historical all of a sudden.
For the first time since...
Is this the first one since The Gunfighters, I think?
Since The Gunfighters, I think so.
And it's purely historical, and it's not even, like, a major historical event historical.
No, there's no famous
just,
people in
it's
it.
It's just upper-class people in the 20s.
Mm-hmm. And part of that is the charm. It's very low stakes.
Yeah.
There's... again, the usual sort of questionable racism, you know, or whatever, appropriate for the 1920s period, I guess. But I like the costumes. I like mm-hmm. the kind of stereotyped Agatha Christie-ish characters. I like the location work.
I just thought of another two-parter. We forgot The Rescue.
Oh, sure, The Rescue. You know, Vicky and Coquillion.
Coquillion.
One of my favorite villain names.
I know. Well played, Pat.
Thank you. Yeah. The Rescue's good. Yeah, I mean,
didn't mean to interrupt you, but I just...
No, that's fine. You know, all of the I've babbled enough, but all of those two-parters that we've mentioned so far, I don't dislike any of them really.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little weird because Doctor Who kind of wasn't designed for stories that short.
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of tell they did the two-parters just because, oh God, we got this tiny little hole in our production schedule. What are we gonna mm-hmm. fill it with something? And
well, I also really like Black Orchid, and I was tempted by that, but I will probably say Edge of Destruction. It is so unique in comparison to the stuff around it. It is the third
mm-hmm. story. Right after the Daleks.
It's a real early one.
And yeah. It is a bit of a character study in some ways. We don't know much about the Doctor yet, and William Hartnell has that great speech as the TARDIS doors are opening at the end, and it's scary. Somebody's pulling a scissors on somebody at some point.
I think Susan tries to. Yes. Susan or Barbara tries to stab somebody with the scissors. I don't remember. I like Edge of Destruction quite a bit too. It's been some time since I've seen it, so I could probably stand to rewatch it. But I remember it as being quite theatrical, like a little four-handed little theater drama, limited sets. You don't totally know what's going on. It's as you said, we don't really know the characters yet by that time, and so the fact that they're acting oddly doesn't register.
And it brings up a rather kind of the far out concept of the TARDIS seems to be somewhat self-aware and is trying to communicate telepathically with people.
That's the first time we hear the phrase telepathic circuit, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of fascinating to me they introduced an element that out there that early in the show.
And for it to create such a kind of cornerstone of what the whole mythology is.
And they clearly were just making stuff up because they
totally
ran out of money.
Yeah,
that's the great thing about Doctor Who.
We have to make two episodes. We have no money except one set.
Yeah, and they're like, I don't know, the ship's driving them crazy. Let's just do that.
Yeah.
What's the threat? Oh, they're gonna blow up at the Big Bang, right?
That's
what the threat is.
Yeah.
Sure, just keep writing. Don't stop.
I remember the design of that episode being quite good, too. It's the first time that we see any of the extended TARDIS interior. We see the bedrooms and things like that. And they have those strange 1960s bed, couch, daybed things that are curved. So they slant down at a diagonal angle with a hump down toward the bottom. Like, you wouldn't want to sleep in them, really. Do you remember this?
I don't remember the strange beds you were describing.
They are there.
Okay.
Take a look when you have a chance, because they're... I hadn't seen that kind of 60s design before.
It has that kind of mod quality to it.
I must have been pretty young when I was watching it, but it was unusual. It was neat, kind of futuristic stuff by 1964 standards.
Is that the one with the food machine, too? Or is that a different episode that I'm thinking
occurs
of?
In The Chase?
Okay, maybe that's what I'm thinking.
No, that's the time-space visualizer where they see the Beatles. I don't remember.
They do pull
there
back.
There is a food machine,
and it has a lot of... interior of the TARDIS, and it is more that style where the TARDIS looks very much futuristic with a bunch of knickknacks that the Doctor has added, which they are kind of going back to with Capaldi, where he's got chalkboards and
he's got the bookcase,
oddball bookcases and things that are very much not modern looking technology.
So those
are my favorites.
Black Orchid, Edge of Destruction. What about you, Calvin?
I was gonna pick Edge of Destruction too. But now I feel like I have to pick something else.
King's Demon. You're a King's Demon man, aren't you?
No, I think my second choice would probably be the Suntaran experiment.
Okay.
Probably because it was originally conceived, from what I understand, that, you know, it directly follows out of the Urken space, and that originally it was going to be, like, all one story.
A six-parter?
Yeah, but then they... somehow, like, at the kind of decided, no, it should be its own standalone thing. And so the Suntaran experiment became a two-part story that they just kind of stuck in there.
I didn't know that production element.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I could see how it could be a six-part story where the last two episodes take place on Earth and maybe the Wirren are there as well or whatever.
It's kind of
unlucky for the human race that they got the Suntaran at exactly the same time as the Wirren come.
Right, but... well, this entire invasion of one.
Right, right.
Who's just there to, like, let's just pile weights on humans and see what happens. But, it was originally going to be some kind of thing where there was going to be this big first chunk of the story on the space station and then, like, the ending part on the Earth.
Yeah, well, it is still narratively really connected. They're going down to make sure the beacons work.
Interesting. It would have been then sort of the reverse of the Seeds of Doom, which has what amounts to a two-parter in the Antarctic base, and then a four-parter at back in England. Mm-hmm. This would have been the reverse of that four and then two. I always did find it a little bit odd, and it kind of undercut the drama of the Arkan space that immediately in the Suntaran experiment, you see colonists, Earth colonists from a different.
From a different
part of the universe there. It's like, oh, I thought the whole human race was at stake in the last four episodes, but I guess there's just these dudes.
It was just the sort of snotty, upper-class, educated part of human culture, and these were like the working-class schmucks from some colony world.
Yeah, you might rather they come back and colonize
Earth.
I just remember Sarah's yellow parka for some reason.
Yeah,
I don't know why.
It's unforgettable.
It's like emblazoned
in
my mind forever.
The other ones, what, The Awakening, King's Demons?
I have a fondness for The Awakening just because it involves the English Civil War.
Yep.
And that's like a thing.
I like the big face.
And The King's Demons is kind of fascinatingly odd, and nothing ever came of Chameleon.
That is such a shame.
I kind of wish they had done, in a weird way, they had done more with Chameleon, like just... have it be a guy in a suit and not use the actual malfunctioning robot.
You know, he could change into whatever he
wanted.
He could have just been a different guest star every episode. And
what was the problem?
Yeah, that's what they did when they finally brought him back in Planet of Fire. They just had him played by Anthony A. Lee and then the guy who played Perry's questionable stepfather.
He was kind of the Handles of the classic series.
That's a future Death Zone, isn't it? Chameleon versus Handles.
Exactly.
we could get 15 minutes out of that.
More.
Oh, good lord.
More.
And now round three, the randomizer. So normally this round will be a discussion of a classic adventure that we choose at random. But for these first three episodes, we've decided to discuss the first story that introduced each of us to Doctor Who. We've already analyzed my first episode, Ark in Space, Joshua's Vengeance on Varos, and today we'll wrap this up with Kelvin's first story, Doctor Who and the Silurians.
Yeah, yeah. I dimly remember this growing up in southern Minnesota. One of the very, if not the very first, one of the very first places anywhere in America to show Doctor Who was Iowa Public Television.
Hmm.
And I forget exactly how and why that happened. But they started showing Doctor Who in, I believe, 1974.
Wow.
Yeah, way back then. Although I don't recall when I saw this. I kind of divide my personal geek chronology as kind of like pre-Star Wars and post-Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember if I saw it before I saw Star Wars or after. But oddly enough, it was brought to my attention by my dad.
Okay.
Which is really strange because my dad had like zero interest in this kind of entertainment. You know, but it was British and not like sort of pointlessly violent like Starsky and Hutch.
Mm-hmm.
like Starsky and Hutch would be like my dad's example of like everything that is wrong with all television entertainment.
We have another Death Zone, Starsky and Hutch.
Yeah, yeah. Who would win? Doctor Who or Starsky and Hutch? But, you know, it's like, oh, you know, there's this show I saw on public television called Doctor Who. And I, you know, you should watch it. And I have a dim memory that I was familiar with the concept of Doctor Who. Like, I read about it somewhere as this long-running British institution science fiction show.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know anything about it beyond that. And I watched it, and it's just sort of like, okay, it's this heroic scientist guy fighting aliens.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm in.
Yeah, and the first one I remember seeing was parts of the Silurians. And the thing I most vividly remember was the younger Silurian killing the older Silurian.
Mm-hmm.
And very saying, he petulant. Wasn't fit to be leader. And then like yeah. walks yeah. away.
He yeah. is like a teenage boy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The petulant, action-craving Silurian.
Having just watched that again today,
yeah,
that scene is still pretty striking.
Yeah.
It's, he's been talking for a couple episodes before that point. Ah, he's not fit to be leader. I'm maybe going to kill him or whatever. And then he kills him. And yeah. it's like, oh, wow. I didn't.
Kills him with the mysterious glowy eye powers.
They're
that have not, never been seen in Silurian since.
Third not eye terribly dead. Well defined.
Yeah.
It pretty much does everything. It's the sonic screwdriver.
The sonic screwdriver of the Silurians.
In their head.
Yeah.
So you don't remember whether you saw it before or after Star Wars, which is kind of a
I know. Benchmark. I might have. I'm tempted to say slightly after Star Wars, but because I think I remember being kind of shocked at how cheap it looked.
Yeah.
You know, like the Silurian costumes are pretty terrible.
Yeah.
And, you know, how cheap the special effects were. You know, just being kind of stunned, like, wow, they actually got away with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they
but
actually.
But something about it made you keep watching.
Yeah, no, I mean, a lot of what kept me watching Doctor Who was just trying to understand what the heck was going on.
You just wanted to make sense of this thing.
Yeah, because I would only see it in, like, bits and pieces. And, you know, especially with the Silurians, there is, like, nothing in it about the Doctor having any kind of alien nature.
Yeah, he mentions it, but very briefly and in passing. And if
it's
you don't understand,
one of understand, the very few episodes you don't see the TARDIS.
Yeah,
anywhere
this TARDIS
yet.
Is not in the background. Anywhere.
Yep. You don't even see the console like he sometimes.
And he's actually not in his normal Doctor outfit that much. He's in
nope.
this. He's in like the weird cave explorer outfit all the time. He's in a white T-shirt fixing like machinery
with his snake tattoo.
With the snake tattoo,
I have to seriously ask a second: how many other doctors could pull off a white tee?
I know
there really aren't many. The ninth, maybe.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah,
for sure.
Christopher Eccleston, but otherwise it's Jon Pertwee. And remember, just in the previous adventure too, in Spearhead from Space, you see him in the shower.
Yes,
and here he's got a tight white T-shirt.
A shower with a bathing. Cap on.
Yeah, he starts the adventure by fixing Bessie. It's so macho. He's so manly.
He's much more hands-on than the other doctors.
Absolutely, especially after the first two.
It's funny to see that he's the original young action doctor.
Yeah, he's the David Tennant of the classic series.
Yes,
but he
can snap David Tennant in two.
But I just kind of thought, like, okay, he's this wacky scientist who likes to wear opera clothes for some reason.
So watching it again, though.
Yeah.
What do you think of it now? Like, do you think it stands the test of time?
It seemed longer than necessary to me.
Seven episodes.
It's a seven episode, and it seemed like it didn't need to be that long.
I think that's fair. Having watched it again yesterday and today, there's a lot of wheel spinning in the first four episodes. This is just kind of standard for these.
Well, like
you don't even
see Silurians until, like, the third episode, and then they're kind of in shadow in the distance or something.
And then you see them, and then you're like, maybe they should go back into the shadow.
Yeah. The dinosaur kind of disappears halfway through.
He's in a little
he's
kennel.
He's in a CSO
He's got a
cage.
Dinosaur kennel, yeah.
Yeah.
So I had a odd... The Silurians was part of my Doctor Who growing up, too.
Yeah.
But because after I got into the show, I saw Ark in Space, as we talked about some time ago, I started picking up the books.
Yeah.
And the books that were published in America were an odd bunch. Mm-hmm. They're presumably part of a series. The first one was Day of the Daleks. Mm-hmm. And the second one was Doctor Who and the Cave Monsters.
Yes.
By Malcolm Hulk, which is an adaptation of his own, mm-hmm. The Silurians. And so once I figured out all the deal with the regenerations and blah, 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 and things like that, the Cave Monsters novelization really stuck with me because what I remember being very frightened of was the contagion. That happens in episode 6, takes a big part of the latter part of the book, and where Masters goes and you follow him on the train and he infects this person and that person and just kind of spreads out from there. That was terrifying to me. It was the first time I had encountered that in fiction, and it stuck with me all of these years. And I've always been a little bit frightened of, well, it's quite in the news these days, Ebola infection, stuff like that, but this really hits me on kind of a fundamental fearful level.
I think how they portrayed it here is in the episode is quite terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like, on one level, the plague story is just makes the story longer, mm-hmm. in a way, but it is like the scariest part of the whole story.
Yeah, the serial spins its wheels probably in like episode 4 and 5, when they're just down in the caves. At one point, I think it's Dr. Lawrence who even just says, "This is ridiculous. Everyone's just running around in caves." And you're like, yes. Yes, it is. And so when the plague comes out, I think it picks up again and has some energy and excitement.
Well, and we get out of the caves and the research facility. It's location shots on film in London, which is rare for Doctor Who. Location shooting in an urban area is... I don't remember too many other examples of that. And here we follow Masters.
Terror of the Autons.
Well, here, I guess, maybe this period, this John Pertwee period, you see a little bit more of that. But usually it's quarries or rural places or whatever. But here you see him in the train station. You see him walking in obvious London sights. And you see real Londoners of 1970 whatever, dressed how they... they're dressed at the time, and it's kind of an interesting time capsule to look at. And so it threatens to expand the story out into the real world, and that's part of the thing that makes it a little bit terrifying.
They fall into that trap, though, where there is no really dramatic, exciting way to portray the discovery of a cure, like the scientific discovery of a cure. They fall back on Eureka, literally.
But they do actually have, like, the doctor, like, in a lab coat.
Yes.
Actually looking at microscope
He's
slides
He's doing
and
science,
stuff.
But it's it, like, it, yeah.
And they milk it a bit because he discovers the cure and then is abducted by the Silurians before he can tell anybody. So Liz has to step in and make it happen. So it gives her something to do, which is always nice for a companion to be effective at some point. And they spin out the drama of that a little bit longer. But as I remember, and it's been many years since I read it, the book really milks that, really milks the contagion even more than episode 6 of the televised
show. Yeah, Malcolm Hulk particularly, I remember in the Target novelizations, would really add a lot and notch things up. Sometimes he'd add a lot of comedy too, and fun extra bits. I think in his Invasion of the Dinosaurs, there's an opening bit with like a drunk student who first sees the dinosaur, and it's all from his point of view. So he's a fun writer of the Target novels.
Yeah, the one thing about the story that didn't work for me, seeing it again after so many years, was the sound is really weird.
The sound design?
The sound design. Like, the Silurian summoning device has like a that weird whistly thing that seemed weird to me, and the music is really strange.
It's electronic.
Is bizarre, though. The tone of it for where they match it with different scenes. It's this weird... It struck me as like the Twilight Zone meets like Laurel and Hardy music. It had this strangely comical quality when over tense scenes, where it's like... Bum, 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 bum.
Well, yeah, they use a crumb horn.
A what now?
They use... it's a crumb horn. It's a medieval reed instrument. That is the instrument they use to indicate the Silurians.
Okay.
I'm going to believe you on this.
Yeah. It's like the composer had all these weird ideas like, well, you know, we have to have this like really alien sounding thing. Like, oh, I'll use these medieval instruments. So it's like, so the Silurians show up and you hear, like that kind of weird super nasal sound. And it's, well, I remember sometimes that motif would come on, and I would be confused and think it was like an alarm going off, like there's some kind
it's
of alarm.
It's time to get up.
No, like there's like an emergency happening in the show, like an alarm is going off, like or something. But then I'd be like, well, why is no one reacting to the alarm? You know, and it's like, oh, it's that stupid music for the Silurians.
You know, I'll still take it over Murray Gold.
I have to agree there. And I mean, it's so what it is, and nothing else sounded like that.
Yeah.
I can't back away from the memories of childhood when I hear that. And I see the Silurians shaking their head with their little red light glowing and that noise coming on. I'm like 12 years old again.
Yeah.
Good, bad, or otherwise, but...
I think they did kind of retcon it later that these were like a subgroup or subrace of Silurians that had the psychic third eye power. Because it never shows up again when the Silurians show up.
Seems like a good thing to retcon. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've always liked this one. It's overlong, mm-hmm. But you know it has a important place in fandom and people generally like it. Partly because it demonstrate something that Doctor Who hadn't really necessarily done before this point, which was the Doctor is not necessarily on the side of human beings in every circumstance. Previously, with Patrick Troughton, with Cybermen invading moon bases and things like that, the sides of good and evil are fairly well defined. But here we have the first, or certainly one of the first anyway, indications of what we're going to see over and over and over again in the new series, which is his divided loyalty, his interest in negotiated peace, things like that, mm-hmm. out-of-the-box solutions, and he's not always even going to be on the side of his friends, and you see that here with the Brigadier. Mm-hmm. And it's justifiably famous for that last section where the Brigadier blows up the caves.
Wantonly blows it up. And
But, you know, I hadn't seen this in a long time. And I have to say, compared to what they do in the new series, there is a lot of subtlety going on here. And it's strung throughout the entire serial. It's brought up a lot by the Doctor. You can't just go in there and start shooting things, Brigadier. That theme is there already. And when it all comes together at the end, both sides have a point in this because... the petulant teenage leader is not dead, and he is getting up before the Brigadier bombs that to mm-hmm. revive everybody and go back after the human race.
Yeah.
And which seems to suggest that the Doctor's plan to wake them up one by one might work, but that there is an argument for not taking the risk.
Right.
They're just not as quick to give the doctor the absolute moral authority, I think, at the end of this.
Yeah.
Because he's upset with a character who we all really like and who he's going to continue to work with after this episode. Mm-hmm. He's not going to kick him out of the TARDIS like he tends to have, like, you aren't good enough to be my companion now in, like, the new series, and that moral indignation. It's not there. I also have to say that Pertwee's performance at the end is really nice. It's very understated. Yep. And really small. He plays the shock. He plays horror and a little indignation, but he doesn't go over the top.
Yeah, I like John Pertwee quite a bit through this whole thing. His comedic, I think they call it gurning sometimes.
Yes, oh, when he gets hit when with
a whenever he's hit ray. With a ray, it looks pretty bad.
He has
bad, but
a strangely goofy, I'm being affected by
rays of various
types. Yeah, psychic powers. I've
got a rubber tentacle around my neck.
He gets all bug-eyed and like, you know. But
that aside, I think his performance is quite good. The other thing I like about this a lot is just all of the other actors who we've seen countless times. I made a list.
Jeffrey Palmer.
Jeffrey Palmer.
He
plays
so
the minister. Of course, for me,
Paul Darrow
really
is
stands
in
out.
It.
He played Avon in Blake 7. He's Captain Hawkins here.
And in Time Lash.
Yes, and in Time Lash, thank you. Peter Miles, the guy who plays Dr. Lawrence, of course, later goes on to play Niter in
Niter.
Genesis of the Daleks.
He's just a hateable little bureaucrat.
Absolutely wonderful. Hateable guy
of humanity.
The guy who plays Major Baker is I had to look this up, but he later goes on to play Hieronymus in The Mask of Mandragora.
Wow, I would never put that together.
I would not, but you could see him. Yeah, and then the guy, the scientist who gets killed at the beginning, Fulton McKay, he's also in British TV shows. Anyway, you can go on and on. But so the Silurians, that was a good.
It's a pretty solid seven-part episode, right. Solid-ish seven-part episode. And I just want to say, probably my favorite thing in the entire thing is that they have ape pesticide to keep apes from their fruits and vegetables they're growing. So we know that Silurians were conventional farmers, not into organic.
Ape pesticides.
And I love that to death.
ape pest.
Boom.
Like you have to put up a scare ape in the garden.
Okay, round four. Wonderful afunctionalism. In this round, we basically do whatever the hell we want. This week, Pat, poet laureate of the Minneapolis Doctor Who scene, has an offering he would like to read for us.
Thank you, Kelvin. This is The Lake Isle of Gallifrey, with apologies to William Butler Yeats. I will arise and go now, and go to Gallifrey, and a crummy barn build there, of hay and artron made. Moral quandaries I'll have there, and a TARDIS built for three, and remember the Shakespeare I've played. And I shall be John Hurt there, and wear some earth-toned clothes, dropping in on Smith and Tennant to let our griefs be bygones. There Clara is superfluous, and the moment looks like rose, and we'll rush after random Zygons. I will arise and go now, for always night and day I hear Dalek guns zapping and the oncoming storm. In Eye of Harmony and Arc of Infinity, I hear it in the Bad Wolf's core. Thank you.
That was written by Sergeant Yates.
Captain Mike Yates.
Captain Mike Yates, yes. I get Benton and Yates mixed up.
And now for our fifth and final round, the Death Zone. In this round, we pair two or more Doctor Who texts or characters from any medium or period in the show's history and see how they stack up against each other. This episode, we're going to be discussing the William Hartnell episode, or adventure, excuse me, The Gunfighters, versus the Matt Smith adventure, A Town Called Mercy.
Yeah.
Ooh. And the
reason, two westerns.
Yes, the reason is, of course, the obvious reason that they're both westerns.
Yep.
They're both set in America, mm-hmm. in the American West, in the 19th century, but they're worlds apart in other ways.
They have a couple weird similarities. They both are made marshals.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
They both order non-alcoholic beverages.
Yep.
At the bar. Which leads me to ask the question, if these doctors don't drink, which doctors drank? We know the third doctor did.
Yeah.
We know the 12th doctor. Mm-hmm. Or at least played with a glass.
I remember a 7th doctor virgin adventure, I think one of Ben Aronovich's, where the 7th doctor got drunk celebrating the birthday of the universe.
Yes. And I think it's fitting that the 7th doctor would drink. I think in Slip Back, the audio adventure with the 6th doctor, they mentioned that he's hungover from something in the beginning. And I think that fits, he would drink for sure. I can't see the 5th doctor.
I can't see any of the doctors being big drinkers.
I think the 4th.
The 4th.
I think he was a secret drinker.
He's a secret drinker.
I think the 4th was intoxicated on other substances.
He had bottles hidden in the roundels. He had a problem.
Another thing about these two adventures is they both have narration, which is fairly unusual for Doctor Who.
That is,
It's sung,
I never thought of that.
It's sung narration in The Gunfighters, and it's straight narration in Town Called Mercy. The sung narration in The Gunfighters is very weird, because it's all over the place. It's like every few minutes.
Yeah, it's constant.
It comments explicitly on the action that's happening, and so it gives you this kind of weird time lady sense, like someone's viewing the adventure and watching it. And oh, by the way, trivia, I had to look this up. The woman who's singing turns out to be Barbara Clegg, the woman who would later go on to play Captain Rack in Enlightenment, if you remember.
Oh
her,
my
the,
god,
the pirate lady.
The pirate lady.
Yeah, so she's the person singing
weird.
The song.
Wow,
that is truly
wonderful.
Weird.
So what do we think about these guys, because this
wow,
is the
yeah,
death
I,
zone. Two adventures and one
competing.
Leaves.
Yes. I
think the Gunfighters is definitely picked on.
It's unfairly picked on.
Unfairly picked on. It is a clearly satirical, farcical episode.
Yep.
It is adventurous, like we said, in its structure with the song.
Yeah. It reminds me a lot of, I don't know if any of you have ever seen those live television dramas from the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me a lot of those for some reason.
Yeah, it's very stagey.
There's like certain kinds of camera angles they use. Like there's a few weird like overhead kind of shots.
Mm-hmm. Especially in the gunfight at the end.
Yeah.
It's of a piece with other westerns at the time, too. Well, it's not of a piece, I shouldn't say, but there were many, many westerns on television. In America, you know, you got Rawhide, Gunsmoke, Bonanza are just the most famous ones. But mm-hmm. other stuff from that area, you got Shane, The Big Valley, Daniel Boone, Death Valley Days, and F Troop. so this would have been what would have been in people's minds when they're watching this. They're like, oh, Doctor Who is now doing a genre that we see all the time on television mm-hmm. that we just haven't done before. And I think that speaks a little bit to the versatility of the program's format in the early years. It didn't...
they would try anything.
Yeah,
literally.
Yeah. From week to week, you could be all over the place.
I think the reasons people didn't like this and still don't like this are they can't get past the song.
Yep.
The song is...
It's intrusive.
Really intrusive.
Yeah.
The accents?
Terrible.
They're terrible.
I think those are the main things. They just can't make it. Or if they just don't like comic Doctor Who.
I think the comic stuff.
And now we have a lot of it in the new series, whereas in the original, it's definitely in the minority. purely farcical or comedic episodes, which I think for the most part this is. There are moments, I think there's some direction-wise, some tense scenes and are done uncomfortably. I think when Johnny, Ringo, and Doc Holliday have their standoff and Ringo has Dodo held at gunpoint, it's directed in a pretty tense way and it's playing it pretty straight. But obviously these guys dressed up as cowboys when they come out
Dodo
of the TARDIS is meant
Dodo
to be.
And Steven are like just complete dumbasses in this episode.
The show knows that, too. The Doctor explicitly calls Dodo's outfit a cliché-ridden convention of the American West. The show knows that it's trafficking in nothing resembling the real American West, but just televisual clichés.
It's kind of funny that of the purely historical episodes, this is the most historically inaccurate.
Oh, yeah.
In so many ways.
It's nothing resembling history, I think.
You know, I mean.
But like you say, it embraces it from the top of the story and saying this is an absurd little ride through a fantasy Wild West.
Its bad reputation in fandom is, I think, heightened by this book that we probably all read when we were a kid, Peter Haining's book, Doctor Who, A Celebration, Two Decades Through Time and Space, which was my Doctor Who Bible as a kid.
Yeah.
He singles out the gunfighters as the worst Doctor Who story up to that point. He says, it was not good, it was bad, and it was ugly. It was certainly the story that decided in the mind of new producer Innes Lloyd that the time had come to rethink the policy of using historical stories in Doctor Who's framework. He clearly hates this, and I think most of us probably read this little write-up on the gunfighters before we ever saw it ourselves, so we were predisposed in our minds to think that it was the worst possible thing ever.
I can't describe it as a good story.
Mm-hmm.
But people are sort of crazy harsh on it.
See, I think it's really sound as a lighthearted romp. It's got great scenes. I think the scene with the first Doctor going to the dentist and stumbling in on Doc Holliday with the girl on his lap and being offered whiskey as an anesthetic. There are some great, very knowing comic scenes.
Well, just the whole basic absurdity of the Doctor has a toothache. Oh, I gotta go and get this tooth taken care of. I have all of time and space at my disposal. Where do I go? How about Doc Holliday's office right before the gunfight at the OK Corral happens? That seems like the most advantageous thing for taking care of a toothache.
Having established that, I think we don't think that it's as bad as its reputation would lead us to believe. There are still...
I don't like it, but
critically,
there
are still things about it that simply don't work, at least for me. One of the most important things is that this is representative of a particular type of Doctor Who episode, especially late William Hartnell episodes, where the Doctor essentially does nothing.
True.
That's a problem with the historicals in general, because they don't want to interfere with history, and we talk about that.
It's a lot about just extricating yourself
from
the situation.
And Hartnell wasn't really capable of doing a lot.
Yep, and the scripters were writing him out of more and more scenes. Here, if this is anyone's story, it's Doc Holliday's. He's the one who takes the action. William Hartnell is, you know, some of the stories of this era, he'll be even on vacation for a week or whatever, and he'll be somewhere else. That's not the case here, but he's trapped in the jail for an episode. He's not really present. He's at the gunfight at the end, but he doesn't do anything. It really makes no difference to the proceedings whether he's here or not. And that's the case also with Steven and Dodo. But and I don't like that in my Doctor Who, really. It's, you could extract him and still have the same story. Then why is it Doctor Who, you know?
I think it's fair enough. Although I will say that I think in lieu of having him involved in the action, they at least give Hartnell some fun comedy bits. I love the first episode cliffhanger when they're waiting to shoot the Doctor, who they think is Doc Holliday, when he walks into the bar and they're forcing Steven and Dodo at gunpoint to sing the song we've been already listening to incessantly, and just the cut between them trying to sing this song at gunpoint and the Doctor strolling toward the bar. It's all this it's not tense. It's really funny. And then the next episode title comes up over the top of it, Don't Shoot the Pianist.
Right.
So, I mean, like I said, it's not going to end up in anyone's top
50.
100. But I found it highly enjoyable. I also serialized mm-hmm. this one, like, yeah. took big gaps in between, and it made it far more lighthearted and entertaining.
I didn't try and watch this straight through. I just watched it episode by episode, and still didn't help for me. I mean, I was still, like, that was partly because, like, I can't watch any more of this, so I turned it off.
Yeah, and my experience was, this came out on DVD not too terribly long ago. It was within the last couple of years.
Yeah.
So it was fairly fresh in my mind when I was rewatching it again for this podcast. And I remember when it first came out on DVD, I watched it, I knew its terrible reputation, and I was pleasantly surprised. I enjoyed it a lot more. But this time through, it wore on me more.
Yes, the song had your wore on me.
Yeah.
I love the idea of the song. If it had been an intro and an outro to the, you know, maybe to every episode, even they could get as much as that, or just to the very beginning of episode one and then the end of episode four. But yeah, someone really liked that song.
They totally did. Apparently, it was composed by a well-known electronic music pioneer named Tristram Vary. Who went on to do real music in other venues and stuff.
Then I changed my mind. There should have been more of the song.
Absolutely. So what about A Town Called Mercy? I recently rewatched that for this podcast, too. And unlike the Gunfighters, that's totally standard Doctor Who. It's absolutely just the kind of new Who episode that you do.
It is.
It's not trying anything
different.
I have very
mixed feelings about it.
Yeah, I remember not liking it very much when I first saw it. And I find this seems to be true in general for me whenever I, like, watch New Who stuff. It's like, the first time I watch it, I don't like it as much, and then I watch it later, and then I like it a lot more the second time I watch it.
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, I would say I agree.
Yeah.
I think I like this one a little better.
I liked it better the second time I saw it. It still really comes off to me like a big... like war on terror analogy thing
mm-hmm.
where like, oh, there's this war on terror. It's terrible. We're making awful choices and doing awful things. Yeah, but you know, we got all these weapons, so might as well use them. You know,
that's where I have mixed feelings about it. It falls apart in the whole moral dilemma area, which new Doctor Who wants to pound into every episode, whether it works or not. And I think overall this episode is built upon it, mm-hmm. so it works better. It's a great premise. It is a compelling dilemma, but I'm not sure if it plays out in a satisfying way.
I found it so conventional. I found it not particularly surprising by new Doctor Who standards. It plays with themes like War of Terror, mm-hmm. War on Terror, but doesn't, I think, explore them in any real depth. I think what it does have going for it is that it looks gorgeous. It's filmed on location in the American Southwest. It's got the high definition, widescreen cinematography. Mm-hmm. This is something that the Gunfighters could not compete on at any level, and most Doctor Who couldn't until just very recently. So, okay, it's not John Ford, but you don't expect that from a Doctor Who episode. It looks beautiful, and the scenery is beautiful, and it's a respectable story that occurs in that beautiful scenery, and so I got to give it that, even though it doesn't blow me away.
Yeah, and I guess I had kind of a the sort of arbitrary, whatever, the cyborg soldier guy. Mm-hmm. I can't remember what
his name. Gunslinger. He has an alien name, but
the cyborg guy just has this sort of totally arbitrary thing where, like, he just doesn't go beyond that one barrier in the town.
Yeah, is that ever explained
as in he does not want to harm civilians.
Yeah.
And he's somehow programmed not to harm civilians.
Okay.
Or after his experience of being tortured and experimented on, very much only wants to punish the guilty person.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I missed that entirely in my first viewing of it. Another reason I was a little dubious about it.
Ridiculous that it has this, like, clear boundary.
Well,
that's
again,
like
a lot of New Who, it takes something that is a great dramatic idea, but then doesn't find a way to justify it very strongly. It's a very dramatic idea of a line that must be crossed, and you have to decide in a town called Mercy who gets thrown over the line and killed. But they don't do much work to justify that image, which is very striking right. and compelling. But narratively, there's not a lot to support it. I also think there's a nice echo, though, that I forgot to mention about the gunslingers, where William Hartnell says there's nothing could induce him to raise a gun in anger. Mm-hmm. And then we have A Town Called Mercy, where we have the 11th Doctor with raising a gun in a lot of anger, which was kind of an interesting little echo when you just pick kind of random connections.
Which you probably wouldn't have noticed if you hadn't watched them.
No.
Back to back like we did.
Although that does point out to me a little bit of a weakness, and I say this as someone who loves Matt Smith, but it's one of those things where I think he's too young and he just can't quite pull off that level of anger. Like, he's not intimidating at all when he shouts in the Dr. Jex's face and he sits right down scared and then throws him across town, out across the line. I just expect the alien just to turn around and pop Matt Smith one, because he's just not that intimidating. There's some, it's just the strengths of actors.
Well,
you can't do
Jex
everything.
Dr. Jex isn't that intimidating either.
But he's very decisive. He's not that intimidating, but it's just one of those things where they want to have these new doctors be so full of rage and intimidating, and often when you cast actors who are 26 and young, and most of the time you're playing how boyish and goofy and childish acting he is. Just one of those things where he seemed really impotent holding that gun. And I don't know if that was intentional or not, but it took a little of the drama out of it for me. Like, where if Eccleston were pointing a gun at somebody, I would duck for cover.
Yeah.
If Capaldi were pointing a gun, I'd duck for cover. But
right, if Tennant were pointing a gun at you, you'd cover your ears because he'd be shouting all the time, "I'm the doctor,"
and having a big moral speech.
So which is it going to be then? I confess this is a tough choice because they're so different mm-hmm. for me. I don't really know on what level to compare them. So I'm going to go with A Town Called Mercy, not because I particularly like it, but because I think it's better at what it's attempting to do than The Gunfighters is, which is an interesting experiment that I think doesn't altogether work.
I think that's a very valid choice, Pat. and I think it comes down to that, because subjectively, I think I personally like something that experiments more, mm-hmm. and even if it fails, like The Gunfighters does in many respects, to something that sticks with the formula and also kind of fails on a couple grounds.
Yeah, and ask me 5 minutes from now, and I might share your opinion.
I might waffle, yep. But, I mean, to me, A Town Called Mercy fails on the moral dilemma. I feel like, and it's maybe part and parcel of the entire new series, where they always have the Doctor have these moral dilemmas in which he's really got a safe decision because he gets to leave at the end. You know, because the moral dilemma is you've got a war criminal in this town and your whole family is in danger. I think most of us here are going to say, let's pass the war criminal out beyond these bounds and get what he deserves to protect my family. And that might have been really interesting in this, but they give that argument to the neurotic 18-year-old kid and sort of undermine that argument. The Doctor even turns his back on him and dismisses him as a frightened human in a very dismissive tone, where I think it's a very valid argument. And if they'd played with that gray area a little more, I might have fallen a little more on the side of A Town Called Mercy.
Fair enough. So I think we're both kind of on the bubble, but we have one vote for each one. So you're the deciding vote here, Colvin.
Oh, great. I love being in this position. But
that's why we put you here.
Yeah, you know, I was all prepared to give this to The Gunfighters because I really didn't like A Town Called Mercy when I first saw it very much at all. Then I watched The Gunfighters again, and now I got to give it to A Town Called Mercy. I just... there's very many things in the Gunfighters that don't work. A lot of the performances are really bad.
Well, if you're going to judge a show based on its performance, Calvin.
I know, but and I don't mean, and not just, you know, the, everyone focuses on the accents, but so many aspects of the performances are bad. The body language is all wrong. I think the sets are dumb looking. I think the I think the costuming is bad. No one has a hat that fits right. No one has a hat that fits right in the Gunfighters, except weirdly enough for the Doctor. The Doctor is the only one who looks comfortable in the Western setting, which is all backwards somehow. But it's not a good production. No.
Fair enough.
That's it. Okay, so resolved. A Town Called Mercy
no
wins.
No one's hat fits.
Wins by a hat.
It wins by a hat. Better fitting hats.
We're almost done, but before we go, it's time to revisit the randomizer. Pat?
Okay, we've talked about Kelvin's first episode, The Silurians. From this point on, in later episodes of the podcast, we're going to be selecting random classic Doctor Who adventures to discuss. We're going to do the first of that right now. So for our fourth episode, the randomizer tells us that... Insert randomizer sound here. Adventure 8. The Whoa. William Hartnell episode, The Reign of Terror.
Whoa.
That's what we're going to talk about next episode.
Wow. Let's hope the hats fit.
Yeah, the hats are better. But our old Dungeons & Dragons dice rolling skills seem to have reared up here. We rolled really low. 8.
And that's our show. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed it, please tell all your geeky friends, or better yet, write a review on our iTunes page. Special thanks to Michelle Schwarzenbauer for our logo, Pablo Jones for our theme song, Tony Carna for recording all this stuff, and Melissa Kirscher for being our very own scientific advisor. If you have any comments you'd like to send to us, feel free to email us at getoffmyworld@gmail.com. Meanwhile, join us next episode when we'll be watching The Reign of Terror. And in the Death Zone, we'll finally be figuring out who is the best doctor of all time.
Yeah.
Until then, this is Joshua.
I'm Pat.
And I'm Kelvin.
Saying, get off my world.
Around when the Silurians were around, they're like, what? They're 200 million years old.
I think we've got our post credits clip there.
I love the idea of a scare ape.